Before we dive into the first episode of The Case Against Adnan Syed, just a little note for our listeners. As many of you may have heard, we had an unexpected and very unfortunate ruling in Adnan's case that was released on this past Friday, just a couple days before this documentary dropped. Now, of course, I know all of you want to hear more about the opinion and why the Court of Appeals of Maryland has reinstated Adnan's conviction and also denied him a new trial. And we, of course, have a lot to say about that. We're going to be bringing it up in this week's addendum. As usual, if you have specific questions about it, feel free to tweet them at us with the hashtag UTAddendum. I also want to say on a personal note that this does put us back a bit. We have numerous legal options, but each of them could take years, even if they are successful. Having said that, I have had to relaunch Adnan's legal fund campaign. We had been fundraising for him for the past 5 years, but we closed the campaign because we really thought we were at the end of the road and we could make do with the bit of money we had left in the bank. We have been paying most of it out in legal fees for the last 4 or 5 years. However, there's no way we can fight ahead with what we have. So I have relaunched, as a trustee of the Adnan Syed Legal Defense Trust, I have relaunched the fundraising campaign. And if each of our listeners gave something small, maybe $5, $1, $10, whatever it is you can do, it would really go a long way. To find the campaign, you just have to go to launchgood.com/freeadnan. Once again, that's launchgood, L-A-U-N-C-H, good.com/freeadnan. And share it, and keep us in your prayers. Thank you, guys. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is Rabia Chaudhary, and I'm here, as always, with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Hi, Susan. Hi, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, guys.
So we are starting a new series. We're starting off our 2019 season, in fact, with this new series that I'm so excited about. I know you guys are. I know our listeners have been waiting for this. We are covering the new HBO documentary, The Case Against Adnan Syed. And here we are to talk about the very first episode called Forbidden Love, which just aired this past Sunday on March 10th.
Serial was the first time that I was able to see the case from the perspective of other people. What I realized then was that Serial, at least, was not going to be a story that was going to exonerate him. And that in the absence of a real smoking gun evidence of his innocence or someone else's guilt, that this ambiguity would always haunt us.
And for those of you who somehow have not heard about the HBO special, right now, for the next 4 weeks, starting yesterday, and for, I guess, what, the next 3 weeks following, HBO is airing parts 1, 2, 3, and 4 of their series on Adnan's case.
Now, here's the thing. You know, HBO announced, I think it was last fall, that the series was being created. And since then, we got tons of messages and tweets, and people are very concerned. They want to make sure, like, either we are aware of this or involved, and we kind of had to keep mum about the whole situation. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about kind of the backstory about how this series came about. And Susan, you want to start with some flashbacks about how Undisclosed came about, and then I'll get into how we got to the documentary.
Well, I guess for people who are just listening now to Undisclosed for the first time, I'm assuming we're going to have new listeners following the show. We've been around since 2015, which is crazy to say. We've been around for 4 years now. My God, guys, how did the time go by that fast? And after Serial came out, well, Rabia obviously was listening to it, and Colin and I listened as well. None of us knew one another, but Colin and Rabia and I all had blogs. And through that, we started talking and ended up doing our own podcast about Adnan's case, or at least what turned out to be season one of the podcast was about Adnan's case. After we wrapped up, we decided to keep covering other cases and other instances of where Justin got it wrong and where we believe there is a chance that the defendants in cases are innocent. So that was never the plan. It kind of just evolved into a multi-season affair. We've covered, what, 12 cases now, guys?
About a dozen cases. But I just want to point out to the listeners, in case anybody loves to go into real detail, if they want to, they can actually still check out our blogs. All that stuff is still there. And Colin, Colin is the only one remaining
Colin
standing as a blogger. Colin, what's the name of your blog?
It is Evidence Prof Blog.
And Susan?
I'm The View from LL2, and maybe once a year you'll find me writing there.
Right. And I am splitthemoon.com. So you will find all, I don't know, hundreds probably of blog posts between the three of us on Adnan's case and other things that we talk about. But so as Susan said, you know, Serial was ongoing in the fall of 2014. We were all blogging. We got together, started Undisclosed the next spring. But as I was blogging during Serial, a literary agent reached out to me and said, you know, you should write the book about this case, because if you don't, somebody else will. It took a little bit of, I guess, persuasion on her part, and Adnan agreeing to it, for me to say, okay, I'll do it. And I wrote the book with Adnan, in fact, with his contributions. And then when the publisher announced the book was going to be coming out in about 6 months, we began getting offers from different producers who wanted to option the rights to the book. And one of them was from Instinct Productions, which is co-owned by Jemima Goldsmith. And she's very famously known as the ex-wife, at least in South Asian circles, as the ex-wife of the current Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan. She was known as Jemima Khan. And the reason that's a big deal is because she actually reached out to me during Serial before she optioned the book, about a year and a half before. She's like our Princess Di. She's a huge celebrity in South Asia. And she's an incredible documentary filmmaker in her own right. She's Oscar nominated. She's done some amazing work. So, you know, they bought the rights to the book. They did not want to make a documentary that was just, they didn't want to just document the book. They wanted to do like a whole another series on it, on what happened after Serial. But the craziest thing that happened was, a couple of months later, she called me to let me know that they tapped Amy Berg to direct the series. And the reason that's crazy is, for any of you who kind of know how Serial came about, that's because I contacted Sarah Koenig one night, a journalist. I was like, I need a journalist. But I did that literally the night that I watched Amy Berg's film on the West Memphis case called West of Memphis. And it was so incredibly well made. And she did this incredible job investigating that case and undermining the state's case. And I literally turned off the TV. I turned off Netflix. I remember this clear as day. And I said, I got to find a journalist. And I found Sarah Koenig. So it's kind of full circle that Amy Berg is the one who did this. And so for 3.5 years, Amy has been investigating with a great team. And yes, Susan, Colin, and I have been involved.
Well, I don't think the plan, I mean, I don't know what the original plan was, but it wasn't certainly 3 years of work on the documentary. It just kind of happened that way.
Right. Susan and Colin both, I mean, and me as well, I mean, we both took an active part in the production of the series, in that we provided kind of like the support that the team needed, right? Like Colin and Susan did like a lot of the, you know, providing the documents and kind of the legal stuff. And Colin, can you want to talk a little bit about like what you contributed and what your involvement was?
Yeah, I mean, so this is a great and thorough documentary team. I've been a big fan of Amy Berg's works for years for various documentaries. And so, yeah, my role in this was they would ask for various documents. I put them in contact with some of the witnesses in the case, some of the lividity evidence, and the medical examiner testimony. I sort of gave them what I had worked on and presented in my blog, and they did some work on that. And so, yeah, essentially talking to them about legal theories, some of the facts, some of the witnesses in the case to then air in the documentary.
So, you know, we've all been kind of in on it, but on the down low. Now, going forward, we're going to be covering these four episodes. Every Monday, we'll have an undisclosed episode to cover, you know, the previous night's HBO episode. But we're also going to have four addenda episodes, which I know everybody loves. And John Cryer will be back joining us to do that. He'll take a break from being Lex Luthor, supervillain. And we'll do a recap and talk some more on the addenda episodes, which will be dropping Thursdays, as usual, I believe. All right. So you guys want to get into it? Episode one, Forbidden Love.
She was in a rush to go somewhere.
And she would have come out of the staircase, directly out of these doors, down this walkway, and right there to her car. She was intending to pick up her cousin directly after leaving, and then going to see Don.
Yeah, well, first, just bigger picture. I'm so glad the documentary happened for many reasons, but also it really sort of helped as we're coming to a close of our first season and then the PCR hearing for Anand's case back in 2016, to know that it wasn't over. The investigation wasn't over. It was still ongoing. It has been this whole time. It's been ongoing. We have not been publicly investigating the case, obviously, but that doesn't mean that there was not stuff going on this whole time behind the scenes. They have done a very thorough job, and I know not all of it, all the stuff that we've learned over the past few years made it in documentary, but a lot of it has, and I'm really excited for this to come out to the world now.
We're already getting questions about whether Colin's bombshell will be in it, but
I did talk with them about the bombshell, but I don't know if it's going to make it to the episode.
We'll find out. I will say this. So, you know, Susan, you said earlier, we didn't expect it to take 3.5 years. One of the reasons it is because the state kept appealing, right? Every time we'd win, his conviction was overturned, the state would appeal. I mean, like what the filmmakers were hoping, HBO, all of us were hoping, was that there would be some resolution in this case by now. And seeing as that there's not, they decided that, you know, enough has happened and they found enough stuff and they have enough of a narrative and new information that they were just going to go forward. And I'm glad they are. Moving on to the meat potatoes of the episode. Colin, what did you think about just kind of very general thoughts, like high overview thoughts about the episode?
Yeah, I mean, my big takeaway is when I listened to Serial as a podcast, it triggered my cognitive legal side of my brain. And that's what led me to write my initial blog post was, oh, there's so many interesting legal concepts and theories that came to life in this case, and I want to write about them. This documentary definitely hit the emotional side of my brain, is that, you know, you see Adnan's family and parents, Hay's friends, you put faces to names, you can hear the pain in people's voices.
Eunice, you all right? You all right, okay? Come on. You want to sit with me? Come on, you can sit. She's shy.
Did you have this, the center when Adnan was
living in? Oh, yeah.
The
house? He used to help me, too. Yeah.
And I got pretty emotional, you know, almost, you know, tearing up listening and watching this first episode. And so that was something I wasn't necessarily expecting when watching this first episode.
And I guess the biggest question anyone has, well, a lot of people have about hearing this documentary on the Adnan case is, what's left to say? What's left to cover? How are you going to cover a story that everyone knows? And I love the way they did it, which is to approach it as if it, you know, it wasn't a case everyone knows, because it isn't. There's tons of new audience here who are not going to be around for Serial, who now see it for the first time. And plus, those who listen to Serial have probably forgotten half the stuff, including us, over the past 4 years. So they just go back to the beginning, and they cover it all. And they reorient you in the case. They remind you who everyone is or tell you for the first time. They don't assume anything.
Yeah, that's the thing. This documentary is not like for people who are just picking up after Serial or picking up after Undisclosed. Like, you can be completely new to the case and you're fine. At the same time, for those of us who are so deep in the case, you know, like the three of us, like Colin said, there is still stuff that's like, I mean, there were witnesses who, or friends actually of you know, Adnan and Hayes. I never actually had seen them before. I didn't know what they looked like. I didn't know what Aisha Pittman looked like. And I didn't know what Laura looked like. I didn't know some of these. I knew the names, I didn't know the faces. And so there was new stuff, and there was, and I think one of the most amazing aspects, especially of the first episode, is how they brought Hay to life.
April 1st, 1998. I got this today at Monet exhibit from the French field trip. I thought it would be cool to write stuff in here about my life. So I guess I would just start with my life so far.
Yeah, when I first heard there was animation, my reaction like gut level was like, oh no.
I thought
I was kind of horrified. And then I watched it.
Yeah. Yeah, we were told that there was going to be some animation, that there was an animator who was going to be kind of animating, and there somebody's going to be narrating like parts of Hay's diary, and that can be, I don't even know what the word is, but it can end up looking not so highbrow, I guess. But Colin, what did you think of the animation?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was well done. It wasn't, I thought, exploitive. I thought the goal was to bring Hay to life, which, you know, the podcast, understandably, couldn't really talk to her family. We didn't get too much insight into Hay. And I think, as Amy Berg has said in these interviews, they got someone to read the diary, and the friend said the voice sounded similar to Hay's voice. And, you know, we don't have archival footage of Hay besides, you know, a few things from the school. And so this was an attempt, I think, in telling this story to basically show Hay's perspective by using the diary entries and the animation. I thought they did a good job.
I ended up loving it. I went from being totally opposed to being like, wow, that works.
Yeah.
And I thought they took some license, but in a way that I felt true to Hay and worked. Like the scene from the prom when they had her racing Stephanie and drawing herself in to match her blue dress to the blue crown.
I thought that was cute.
And obviously that's not literally from the diary. It's not literally something that happened.
Right.
And it was, you know, artistic license. But to me, that that fit.
I was just kind of stunned watching the animation. It was touching to me. Oh God, I'm going to get emotional. It was touching to me because that has been something that people have brought up over and over again. And really, as Colin said, like, we have just been at a complete loss. How do you address Hay's story in all of this? How do you find her voice when we can't find the family to talk to us, or they don't want to be involved? What do you do beyond going, you know, to the diary, which is almost all we have left? Although I will say, I was kind of shocked to see there's so many pictures in this first episode of Hay in school with friends. Like, I had never seen them before. It was the first time I'd ever seen them. And I'm guessing that they were able to get these photographs through other friends who appear on the first episode and others. But, and also, they didn't just animate Hay in it, right? So, like you said, you know, like, they animate the scene from the prom. And Adnan's animated in it, too. And also, Adnan is somebody who's kind of missing visually from this story the entire time, right? You don't see him in Serial. You don't see him in our podcast. We don't see Adnan ever. But here you get to actually see him through the animation.
And you get to see him once in that one clip where he's walking into the Baltimore. Is that the PCR hearing?
It's a PCR hearing.
Basically, what they have is they drive him up in the, you know, the van, and they have these gates that swing out of the sidewalk so that inmates can walk into the court from the transport van. And there's one shot they got of him being walked in. And of course, the guard happens to be on the side between the cameraman and Adnan. So all you see mostly, again, is the guard, which is sort of fitting for
exactly
how
that's
it
what I thought
told so far. Yeah.
I actually thought that was, I know it was intentional. Like, there's other footage out there that you can see Adnan.
Not theirs. That was where
it might
they
not
were.
Be theirs, right? But they could probably use other news footage. I mean, like, if they wanted to license it or something. But I think they very purposefully took a shot where he's kind of obscured, because in a way, the series is gonna, I think, start to unobscure him. Is that a word? I don't know. one thing I thought. It's like, this is so ridiculous. I told Adnan this, actually, and he laughed. When your mom sees, like, the animated scene of you and Hay kissing, it's really going to piss her off, because she's always going to be that auntie. But anyway, I thought it was beautifully done, the way they captured Hay. And there is, there's also a community member who knew Hay, who's interviewed and who is part of this. And I thought it was fantastic that they were able to include her in it.
Hay's family obviously did not want to participate, and that's... I mean, very understandable. I understand totally their call. But at the same time, as a filmmaker, I know that Amy and them really wanted to include what they could of her life. And they found a woman who knew the Hayes family from the church, I believe. And she was willing to talk on camera about the family and what she remembered of events.
Yeah. And it was pretty devastating to hear that.
With the winter blues coming to an end, it's finally time to get back into a routine that empowers you to feel your healthiest. Care of delivers daily vitamin and supplement packs customized to your recommendations to promote personal health and wellness. It can be really hard to find out what vitamins or supplements you should be taking, but Care of makes it easy to find out. Care of's fun online quiz asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices, and takes only 5 minutes to find out your personal, scientifically backed vitamin and supplement recommendations. Plus, Care of's delicious, nutrient-packed quick stick powders can be added to your monthly delivery for an extra easy boost wherever you need it. Now, I've been using Care of for about a year, and it's been a great experience. It was really easy to take their online quiz, and I was able to order exactly the vitamins and supplements I needed without having to go to the store for an initial order of refills. And their packs made it easy for me to have my vitamins and supplements both when I'm at home and on the road. And now you too can do the same. For 50% off your first month of personalized Care of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter undisclosed 50. That's takecareof.com and enter undisclosed 50.
Somebody else that we kind of hear from or see visually for the first time, I think, in this entire narrative is Adnan's father.
That's the first time I was not even sure he'd appear on the film. I knew that he's always been very publicity averse.
Have you or Colin ever seen him before?
No. I've seen me many times, but I know Adnan's father is, and you can tell, you can see in the documentary, you can see firsthand how it's broken him.
Oh, I think he kind of became a hermit, you know, after Adnan's arrest. I call him Father Time sometimes because he's got that appearance, but he's just a real gentle soul. And I'm so glad that they were able to get him on film because I was so positive that he wasn't going to do it. I was like, there's no way he's going to do it. I think he agreed to do it in moments where there was nobody else around, though, and that was maybe the only thing that made him comfortable doing it. But, you know, when I see him, it's like for a blip, he'll come out, say hello, kiss the kids, go back into his bedroom.
My favorite line, one of the show that was, I think it was from Tanvir, where he was saying that their father said, like, he can't be dating girls and getting those grades.
Clearly, Uncle does not know how dating works. I think it's fair to say. See, like back home, if you're dating somebody, I mean, what that really means is you are just pre-marriage. So think, you know what I mean? Like you're that involved. You're about to get married to this person. That's what that means. What did you think about like the inclusion of Adnan's family, Collins? Anything that stood out to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, I thought, well done. They have the scenes there, obviously, of Yusuf and Shamim, and they're running the daycare center, which they had that back in 1999 as well. And just, I think, sort of the footage of Shamim, his mother's face, and seeing the impact this has had on her. We can see, for both his father and his mother, the impact. She kind of seems more of the soldier through it and have a strong front, whereas, you know, as you noted, it sort of broke him, it seems, and has had more of an overt effect on what he's been like the last several years.
Yeah, and, you know, other than Adnan's father having to testify at the trial, he's never been to any of the hearings, any of the appeal. He just can't emotionally handle it. So she has been the rock. She's the one who's always there, always soldiering along. All right, let's talk about all the friends that appear. All these kind of, you know, folks that, who did we hear from in Serial?
We heard from them all. And I'd seen photos of all from
Debbie too?
High school.
I don't remember Debbie.
Oh, we didn't hear
Serial
from her directly. I don't remember. But we heard from her recording. This is the first time I've seen, I've seen Krista obviously, but first time I've seen in Asia, but I'd never seen what Laura or Aisha or Debbie look like now.
Me and Hay played field hockey together. That's when we became friends. Both of us were fans of sports, but didn't really ever pay attention to them. So, like, she was a fan of the Dallas Cowboys, but probably rarely watched an actual football game. She liked the blue and silver.
And it really gave context to the fact that this is something that's affected not just them then, but even today with Serial, it's impacting lives of adult people who've gone, you know, had a tragedy this many years ago in high school. And now today, it's affecting their daily life pretty consistently for years.
And the interesting thing about this group of friends, it's not that they were just Adnan's friends or Hay's friends. They were all friends. So they were just as close to Adnan as they were to Hay. You know, they're all part of the magnet program, which we did hear about in Serial. So what they do in the first episode is they lay all of this out. It's an excellent foundation. I think what they did is really difficult to do because they've got these different timelines that they're going back and forth. They're trying to explain who Hay was, what her relationship to Adnan was, and then what happened to her. So let's talk a little bit about how they get into the actual, you know, her disappearance and murder and what happens then.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of confusion and uncertainty about what happened, obviously, when she disappeared and what happened in the weeks following. And I think the documentary sort of conveyed that by showing how today, even after Serial came out, after it's been so public for so many years now, the people involved still don't fully remember exactly or don't always agree on what happened, sequence of events. Like, Krista recalls that her moment of, oh gosh, something could be wrong here, is after her party that she had on the 15th for 18th birthday, when they're all wearing those, like, extremely 90s clothes. And Hay, they're like, oh, they're not worried. Like, oh, Hay will come by for the party. And after the party,
and this
like,
is 2 days after Hay disappeared. So,
2 days.
Yeah, 2 days later. Yeah.
And Hay never showed up for it. And when they realize that after the party's over, she never came, they're like, oh, that's something strange. But Aisha, Hay's best friend, was talking about how she wasn't really concerned or didn't think anything could be wrong until they found her body. It seems like it was this thing where, in hindsight, yes, they all should have been very, I mean, it seems like it should have been obvious something terrible had happened. But in the moment, they didn't feel that because these are kids asking. Adults aren't saying anything's desperately wrong. They're like, oh, she's off somewhere. And yeah, it doesn't make much sense now thinking back. But at the time, it seems like they largely kind of accepted it.
Yeah, well, you know, what I found interesting, which maybe I just didn't remember from having worked in this case years ago and, you know, sort of working a little bit more recently, is Hope Shaw appears on this portion of the documentary. She was the French teacher who Hay worked for. And, you know, you first see her and she appears young even now, you know, in 2018 or whatever. And, you know, what she says is basically the police approached me to ask questions of the student because I was a young teacher at the time. I often interacted with the students as basically more of a peer than as a teacher.
I was asked by the detectives, being that I was younger in age and close to a lot of the circle that she ran in, if I would make up some questions that I could give to the girls to kind of ask around to see if any of the magnet students knew what was going on.
Well, no. Her statement is she felt like she felt like a mother to Hay and the others, which I can see now as a teacher with many years of experience is probably supposed to students. But from what we know about back then, there's definitely a vibe that she was treating these students who were like, what, 4 years younger than her
as
a peer and friend, as more so than as, you know, as a parental.
Which makes sense to me.
It does. She was barely older than them. She's barely older than them now. But there was definitely a closer relationship there than there were with a lot of teachers, which is part of why she must have gotten so involved in it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is definitely one of the most troubling parts of this investigation to me, is that in effect, this teacher was deputized and she was close in age to these students, where it's kind of both of those. She both is close in age and is a bit of a friend, but also is a bit like a mother figure. And so to have her giving these questions to Debbie and the other students to ask about, you know, Adnan and Hay and all these issues, that's not ideal at all to do for an investigation. It places the students in an awkward position, the teacher in an awkward position, and it just creates credibility issues there for that investigation.
And you have to ask, like, why wouldn't the police themselves go talk directly to the students?
Because then they get real answers from teenagers, probably. Or is possible even Hope was like, oh, look, I can do better at getting answers from these students than the police. It was probably true, to be honest. Or at least get more honest reactions.
Yeah, maybe. So I got an interesting vibe from her. Maybe I was just reading it wrong. To me, like, because, you know, Hope Shaw testified at the trial. And to me, her demeanor in the trial seemed much more kind of like forceful and suspicious of Adnan. I mean, she was a state witness. She was a non-defense witness. But she seemed to kind of have pulled back on that, like in at least in the documentary, in the footage that I don't know if it was just my perception, but she almost seemed a little bit sheepish about the whole thing. Like she was trying to kind of explain this is kind of how it happened or why it happened. And
I got a similar impression that she, you know, she's definitely not like she views the case and has been for a long time that Adnan's guilty. But it seemed like there could have been an asterisk there now. Like she was hedging a bit. And the documentary didn't get into all the details, though. Like it didn't actually explain how invasive her questions had been. The questions that she gave to Debbie. And they were like, where did Hay and Adnan like to have sex? Like all that, like extremely graphic questions.
Right.
One thing that's always stuck with me about Hope Shaw's testimony is that the way she testifies at trial is a little bit different, or at least the impression she left, and undoubtedly why the prosecutors called her to leave that impression, was a little more, it was definitely more incriminating than reality.
Definitely.
At trial, for instance, at the first trial, she's asked about a time that Adnan came up to her and was like, hey, I don't, can you not ask so many questions about me? I don't appreciate you asking questions about me. And they introduced the testimony to show how guilty Adnan is, because, like, obviously anyone's concerned about a teacher asking their sex life, that's a sign of guilt. What she testifies at trial, though, is that, quote, I was asked to ask Gerald Russell, who was a track coach, if Adnan was in practice on a certain day. And that was what I was told to do. And I suppose that Adnan found out about it because he came up to ask her about it, essentially. That's not what happened. The reason that the time happened where Adnan, not in private and public, like, went up to her at class, like, hey, he didn't ask questions about me, is because he found the questions in Debbie Warren's planner. But the way it comes off at trials is as if this guy hears someone's checking into his alibi and freaks out, which is, to me is, I don't want to call it incriminating, but certainly more incriminating than reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think to Susan's point, yeah, I mean, even when she's talking about the hug she gives to Adnan and saying, you know, he was stiff, and she's like, well, you could interpret that one way, you could also interpret it another. Again, I sort of see it as essentially the police deputizing Hope Shaw, and she kind of feels like she's an arm of the state in the prosecution. And probably unconsciously, that means when she testifies at trial and she's called as a state's witness, she's going to slant her testimony a bit against Adnan and in favor of the state. And it does seem like as this decade and a half or more has passed and she's farther removed from the situation, she's reflecting on it. It does seem like she has questions about what happened. That's not to say that she thinks he's innocent, but I think having been removed from the case and her role in it, sort of working for the state, she can have a more objective, nuanced take on it.
I was at an event last week, and Robbie was there too, and Laura Estrada, who you see in episode one, was also there. And she was talking about how, after seeing Hope Shaw's comments in the documentary, she mentioned, what was her line? She was like, you know, I remember that. Watching the documentary, I remember being there. I remember the time that Hope Shaw, Ms. Shaw, came up to hug Adnan and how awkward it was. And the way she described it was a different impression of how Hope Shaw had tried to describe it as like, oh, look, he was just really hostile to me. Mm. Whereas, as Laura calls it, everyone was just sad and it was just awkward. And then that's what stood out to her. It was a very different sort of takeaway from the whole scene.
I mean, it's just one of those things where in hindsight, you can look at an event and filter it through whatever information you know at that point. I mean, we're talking when Hope Shaw testified, we have to also remember, and all the students at the school, and Laura talks about this. She talked about this actually at that event where she's like, you know, we were told there was DNA evidence against him. I mean, like.
And fibers and fingerprints.
Right. And so I can understand that. But I wonder how much of the story Hope has been following now and if she's listening to Serial and I can send her my book too, but I don't know if I should, if that'd be appropriate or not.
You know, when we first met at the Night for Justice gala, you said, you know, the way in my culture it would be a handshake as opposed to a hug. Is there anything in terms of Adnan being a male in his faith and culture and a female teacher hugging him that would be uncomfortable or awkward specifically?
It depends on the person. The person that Adnan was, no. There are people who are a little more culturally conservative and they would not hug a person of the opposite gender because it just doesn't happen back home. It just
What was the party we're at, Rabia? Who was it? It was like your house and someone was trying to troll or fawn your husband by pretending to hug him.
Oh, yeah. No, I put Amelia up to it. I said, go hug my husband. I said, go hug. He's given up now. And remember, actually, last week at the event, he was just hugging everybody, and I was too. So I was like, whatever. But there's a point where you just kind of, because you know, you live where you live. But for Adnan, it wouldn't have been a gender thing. Because first of all, Adnan is dating and smoking pot and going to parties.
It wouldn't have been a Muslim thing, but it would have been a high school boy thing, having a teacher come up and be like, try to hug you.
Yeah. And it could also be, and I don't know how long this was after, I'm guessing it was in the day or so after they found her body. So it sounds like a lot of these kids were just kind of walking around in shock and, you know, he's trying to process this and
it's not his teacher. He doesn't know her well.
So there's plenty of ways to interpret it, but I don't, the cultural lens probably wouldn't work for Adnan. I think the picture from Krista's party, I noticed this. I think there's a little, it looks like Adnan is like grinding on Debbie, but anyway, I could be wrong, but
I gotta watch again now.
In one of the pictures. I was like, uh-oh, don't let Auntie see that. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as the 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Undisclosed a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at undisclosed.robinhood.com. Let's move on. Mr. S, let's talk about Alonzo Sellers and how he found the body. I thought this was fascinating because we get to see for the first time like the trial footage of Alonzo Sellers, what he looks like and what his demeanor was like. You know, it's very different than when you just read trial testimony.
Listen to Ms. Gutierrez. We have some questions for you.
Mr. Sellers, let me direct your attention back to February the 9th, 1999. Do you recall that day?
I don't recall that day. I don't know what you said.
Well, sir, you recall the day that you found the body in Lincoln Park, don't you?
Yes, okay, I recall that
day. That was a pretty important day for you, was it not?
Objection.
If you explain that, I wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Although his trial testimony, too, you do get a very consistent picture of him being, like, not wanting to be there, being not, I don't know if hostile is the correct word. There's definitely a vibe of hostility to it, but it's more, it's not
antagonistic
sort of hostility. Antagonistic, but not like in your face. Like, he knows he has to be there. He knows he's been compelled. He's in a court. He's clearly not going to like do something he knows is going to get him in bigger trouble. But he is not there in a spirit of cooperation. I wouldn't say he's as bad as Jin, who comes off as extremely antagonistic and like you know, mouthy and like
eye rolling teenager,
basically sassy the whole time. Whereas he is just like very like, I'm not going to give you an inch. If you ask me a question I can't avoid answering, I will answer it. But I am not going to give you an inch.
Well, you know, what they explore with him is not just his demeanor at the trial, which I thought was, I mean, I guess my question would be like, why? I don't know, why would he be having that attitude unless it was just a thing of like, I have to miss work for this. He's just annoyed in general. But dude, you found the body. So it's all about how he found the body. I mean, that's kind of like, what did you think the documentary was getting at, Colin, when they were showing how difficult it was to find the body?
Well, I think exactly that this wasn't an accidental discovery. I mean, they, you know, are showing the photo and supposedly there's a foot that you can see in the photo. And I'm sitting there looking at it on a pretty big screen TV. And it takes me a good 20 seconds or so before I'm like, oh, wait, is that actually a foot? I can't imagine I would have seen that in Lincoln Park if I'm just going there to sort of relieve myself. And then the other point, of course, is that this is a guy who is known for streaking. And he's, of course, testifying about going far into the woods to avoid people seeing him urinate. And so I think the question here they're obviously implying, although they're not too overt about it, is this didn't seem like an innocent discovery. It seems like he knew what he was looking for.
Alonzo Sellers is an interesting figure because he's on Serial, and not the same extent, but a little bit in the documentary as well. They give off like a sort of more harmless vibe to it. In police reports, you can see they called him the Bunny Man for his like very frequent sort of streaking efforts. But it wasn't just streaking. I think that gives a more, like whimsical feel to it. As opposed to what in reality, he was a pretty aggressive streaker. There was very much like cornering women, making aggressive gestures. It's a much more disconcerting story when you look into the police reports. It's sort of a threatening air in some of those incidents. I do believe Alonzo Sellers is lying. I don't believe his story for various reasons. The whole thing doesn't make any sense. I don't think that in any way implicates him in the murder. I think the fact that he came forward is strong evidence he probably wasn't involved. My own guess is that he probably didn't even go see the body on his way back to work with that 22-ounce can of Budweiser that day. But that's the day he decided to come forward and tell someone about what he'd seen or heard about before. And again, doesn't mean he knew how the body got there, but I think it means he knew the body in advance somehow, and then after thinking over it some time, decided to come forward.
One of the things I had wished they had done in the documentary, because they didn't make this clear, they showed like a little diagram of him like, you know, driving from home to work after grabbing the beer. But one of the things I kind of wish they had done was actually kind of take a camera and show what that would have looked like. Because one of the things that's important to know is that when he's driving back to work, he's on the opposite side of the road from where the body is. So his truck pulled
over.
Also
not far from work.
Also not far from work, right.
Or home.
The truck pulled over on the opposite side of the road. Now, he could have taken a leak on that side of the woods, but he crossed the street. And if they had taken a camera and done that, crossed the street, walked back into the woods as far as he had to go around the same time, and then, you know, panned the area to show what it looks like, it would have been more of a visual in terms of showing how unlikely that story is and why. I know I don't believe it. I know, Susan, you don't believe it. I think that's an interesting theory that he might have known about it or found them. See, the thing is, he couldn't have just known about it. Like, he had to have, because he knew the location.
He had to have gone in. So it's possible that he was told about it and then went looking for it and found it. And I'm not sure if he actually found it by accident, maybe while streaking, being the Bunny Man, or if he'd heard about it and then gone to look for it and happened to find it. I just don't believe he stumbled across that day while going out to urinate.
You know, the city surveyor who went out to with the team, the police and everybody after, you know, Alonzo Sellers reported finding the body, he said he went and stood right on top of it and he still didn't see it. So Unlikely story. And you know what? The filmmaker, Amy, asks Detective Massey about the story. And I thought it was, I did not know that Massey was interviewed for this. So I was surprised to see him.
I did. I was super excited. Well, so here's the thing. No police officers want to participate in this whole show except for Massey. He's the only one who agreed, probably because he loves the camera and loves his connection to The Wire and loves.
Well, can we talk about Massey's role in the case? Colin, do you remember what his role was in this, in the investigation?
Yeah, I mean, his role, I think, probably his only role, but maybe Susan can correct me, is that he's the one who claims to have received the anonymous call that puts them on the path of Adnan, where this caller, he writes down, it was an Asian male between 18 and 21 and essentially points the police in the direction of Adnan, the ex-boyfriend.
You mean Adna Ansayed?
Well, right, yeah, it's spelled in an odd way, right, but it's, yeah, I think we can kind of decipher it as Adnan Sayed. But yeah, he claims he got this anonymous call, and that's his claim for why the investigation turns to Adnan instead of Don, the new boyfriend, is we had this anonymous call. And there's all sorts of questions. Massey has a checkered history. He was involved in a scandal with overtime pay. There have been other cases where he's made up evidence and been involved in wrongful convictions. So, and even in this case, it was the case where Gutierrez's defense counsel tried to track him down for having him testify and just couldn't find him, couldn't get him to appear.
That's right. Why, to me, it was so ironic that he was the one who agreed. Because they tried many, many officers. And the only one who agreed was the one who literally no one could find time of trial. They ended up having to stipulate the evidence just to avoid having come in because he just mysteriously couldn't be found anywhere. Whoops. Basically, it was very clear they did not want him under oath talking about this call.
Okay. So let's talk about that call briefly. Now, all these years, we have always debated what does the word Asian mean? Because there are different kinds of Asians involved in this case, South Asians and East Asians.
Or Orientals, as they put the Adnan's race is marked as O at one point.
Orientals, okay. But here it sounds like Massey's being pretty clear that he means somebody who's... He says Korean, doesn't he? It sounds like he's talking
he
about...
He does. That is something we've never known before. We've always wondered if it was like, you know, like East Asian or Southeast Asian. Well, he says now he believes it was probably Korean, which to me indicates, if assuming he has a memory of this call and assuming the call actually ever happened, which I'm not going to concede, the caller was someone who sounded... could have been Hayes' family, which would possibly implicate Hayes' brother, because it's hard to think of who else would be calling.
Hayes' brother would have been a little bit younger. He was probably 16, maybe 17 at the time this call was made. But yeah, I mean, plausibly him. But I also don't know, I mean, how do you limit it to Korean? I don't know many people to be able to say this is Korean as opposed to, say, you know, Chinese or Japanese. I don't know, maybe in Baltimore he would have more insight, but that seems awfully specific to me.
I think he couldn't tell Korean versus like Chinese, Japanese. That's why I wrote Asian. To him, that meant like East Asian, as opposed to like, I feel like you could tell like a Pakistani accent from a Korean accent.
But let me stop you guys for a second, because here's the thing. We see in this episode, we see Hayes' brother, her younger brother, talking to the media, testifying. If I were to close my eyes and listen to his voice and his accent, I don't think I could identify him as Asian. I could identify an accent, but I wouldn't know what it was. It doesn't sound like an overtly Asian-influenced accent to me. Does it to you guys?
Well, one important point for me is they use subtitles when he talks. And if I closed my eyes and didn't see the subtitles, I'm not sure I could make out what he was saying. So that would be, I think, difficult for it to be the brother, for Massey to have the notes he has as clear as they are, because it's tough to understand what he's saying.
Also, why would the brother call anonymously? Why would he do that? I mean, the implication, I think, from the notes is that it's supposed to be like someone of hate, like one of Anon's friends is turning him in.
This call actually happened. It was before her body was found. Now, the one reason, because I really thought about this when I saw this, I said, you know, it is actually quite possible that it was the brother or somebody from the family. Because remember, even before the body was found, the family had brought in that cultural consultant. We've talked about this in Undisclosed in the past, who wrote this memo. And I think the family was already focused on Adnan, and so were the police to some extent. But I think the family was very, very convinced, especially given that consultant's involvement and her conviction that it was like a Muslim honor killing thing, that I can see that maybe the brother was like, I'm just gonna make this call.
It seems like everything in this case starts to take up a heightened sort of sense of importance starting around February 1st. There's not really much indication anyone had any concerns about her being gone until then. That's like about when they do the dog search, they use a hairdryer to give her the dog's scent to go off of. I think Laura in the documentary even recalls seeing the dogs, which I kind of wondered about. I'm like, if you see the police getting out dogs to look for a scent trail, And that still doesn't tip you off something's really direly wrong. That's how much in denial they all were. But to me, it seems like something happened around the time. They've changed this. They're open now to the possibility that this is a murder investigation. And it's about the time that, you know, they have the Crime Stoppers ads going out.
Well, here's my question following up on this, Rabia, and also Susan. This write-up of the anonymous call by Detective Massey says, this time that caller remembered about a year ago, the suspect informed a friend of his, Basser Ali, which is Yasser, if he ever heard his girlfriend, he would drive her car into a lake. Now, how would Hay's brother or anyone connected to Hay know about Yasser and be able to use that in the call? So that sort of leans to me on the side of this is a made-up call by Massey. But yeah, I mean, how would they know about Yasser to then have that in the call?
If they weren't concerned with this call, they'd have had Massey testify under oath. They went out of their way to make sure Massey would not be under oath for this call.
Yeah. I mean, the police would know about these guys because the police have the phone records and they know who is he's calling and who his friends are. So, but yeah, okay, that could be it.
Well, they didn't even try and trace it. Like, I have other cases from Baltimore in 2000 where they got anonymous calls. First thing they do is do a freaking search for the phone to find out where it came from. Like in another Ritz case, the Ezra Mabel case. They had a call, so they did a search on it, found what payphone it came in from, and started monitoring it. They made no effort here to do that.
And one of the big points of this first episode is to say, it goes into Hay's history, of course, and reveals an incident that hadn't been revealed before. And that leads to then Hay not wanting to have friends or boyfriends come to her house or have really much interaction with her family. And that's why, yeah, it's tough for me to see how, if we're talking about anyone who is in Hay's family making this call, they'd be mentoring Basser / Yasser Ali. You would think it would have to be someone from their school or their friends making this call, but then who is Korean or that type of Asian who'd be making this call? We're not aware of anyone who would have that knowledge.
I mean, I feel very confident Massey's making the whole thing up about who called and his memory of the voice. Yeah, I think the whole probably Korean thing is just him making shit up.
Right. I mean, they needed a credible, because when he was asked in the episode, how come, like, how about Alonzo Sellers and how about Don and how about these other leads? He's like, oh, yeah, we checked them out. But we had to really focus on Don once the call came in. Like, he identified that as being the point at which Adnan became the suspect, like the lead suspect.
But he was like, yeah, we would have looked at Don, but Don didn't have the phone calls coming in about him.
I don't think he didn't go uninvestigated.
His alibi was his mother, and so there's a question of...
Would a mother lie for him? Sure. He could have caught equal attention that the defendant did, but he didn't have any phone calls coming about him.
And it shows just the mindset they had of like, oh, a teenage girl is missing. It's going to be, well, it's the boyfriend, the ex-boyfriend of the family. In this case, they didn't even really look at the family or the ex-boyfriend. They just looked at the boyfriend. But just the whole approach is just so wrong. And one thing that I feel has always been overlooked in this case is the possibility of this was not someone in Hay's life who was involved, that this was, in fact, a stranger-related incident.
If this was a stranger, how would Alonzo Sellers hear about it? Like, I'm just trying
That opens a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, I guess it could be a stranger who's just a local stranger, right?
Well, so here's some examples that I have pulled up while researching this case of women being abducted from cars near Wood Lawn in the time period where Hay went missing. September 1997 at Owings Mills Mall, the same mall that Hay was going to go work at that night or that evening. On that date, a man forced his way into a woman's car in the parking lot and tried to sexually assault her, but she was able to get free when the car hit a bump and she threw herself out of a moving vehicle to escape. October 98, at the McDonald's on the Baltimore National Pike, it's just next to Westview Mall, just next to where Jen Pusateri lived, a woman was in the McDonald's parking lot at 1:30 in the afternoon, and a man wearing yellow striped gloves and a red sleeve jacket forced her into his car at knife point. He drove down to like a wooded, secluded area in Patapsco Valley State Park and sexually assaulted her, but she escaped and ran away. December 4th, 98, on Liberty Road, the road between Woodlawn and where Hay was heading to the daycare center, a woman left a bar one night. She was forced into a car by three men. She was beaten, sexually assaulted, and her unconscious, partially clothed body was dumped in Lincoln Park. She survived. She woke up about 5 that morning, was able to stumble for help off of the North Park Road. But they had no leads, couldn't find anyone, until finally, like 4 years later, they finally ran the rape kit, got the DNA, and got like an instant match in the database, and found the rapist, who 3 years after that, again, they finally tested a rape kit that they left sitting on a shelf forever. And there's another rape. This time it was a September 2000 abduction rape where a woman walking in that area was pushed into a car and driven to Woodlawn Memorial Park, not very close to the school, and raped, but she too survived. And that man lived like 5 minutes from Camp Field Early Learning Center. Or December 17, 1998, in Towson, Maryland, a 24-year-old Pikesville woman was driving along the highway just north of Baltimore. It was like 2:45 on a Thursday afternoon, and a van forced her car off the road. When she got out to be like, hey, dude, what's going on? He forced her into his van and tried to drive away until a third motorist intervened. February 99, again,
just goes on and on.
Liberty Avenue. Yeah, rolling road. And it's, again, close to where the previous one was and not too far from Campfield Early Learning Center. Woman at a gas station, abducted in her own vehicle, forced to an ATM to withdraw money, survived. September 99, at a apartment complex just off Liberty Avenue and Baltimore Beltway, so where Hay would have been driving that day, probably to get to Canfield. A woman was going to her church in the morning, and she stepped out of her car to change the CD player, which was in the trunk of the car. And as she's getting back into her car, a man forces her into her car at knife point, pushes her over to the passenger side, and drives her to Woodlawn Cemetery, where he sexually assaulted her, but then got spooked when a guy drove by, and she escaped. October 99, a Laurel woman stabbed to death in the wooded area. Her estranged husband was interrogated. He confessed to the murder, spent close to a year in jail awaiting trial. Even after the rape kit came back, it was not his DNA. They only let him go when they actually did find out who the DNA belonged to, which was a man who had committed like 8 assaults in the past 6 months, one of them being a carjacking and rape not far from Woodlawn, just over near Ellicott City. November 99, in Anne Arundel County, so like just south of Baltimore, a 17-year-old Mead High School student was going to school one morning, parked her car in like the student parking lot, was just starting to walk towards homeroom when a man who'd driven in after her forced her at gunpoint, or pretended to have a gun, forced her back into her car, drove her away from the school and raped her, dumped her out, and then drove the car back to the school, got his own car, and left. I mean, that's an example of a high school girl being abducted in her high school parking lot not far from Woodlawn. So to me, the idea that it has to, like, the question here is, like, is it the boyfriend or the ex-boyfriend is so misguided, because there were an extremely high number of carjackings and rapes in Western Baltimore in this roughly, like, 2-3 year period.
Well, it's, you know, misguided mostly not just because this is the state's case, but also because there is this idea that there has to be somebody who's got, like, a motive that is like some kind of personal motive, and that random stuff like this doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, people don't randomly pick strangers to, no, but they do. They do pick. People pick random strangers to victimize. I mean, there's not always a personal connection and a personal motive.
And the idea has always been that Hay was driving somewhere, so she couldn't have possibly been intercepted by a stranger. It had to be someone she knew. When no, there are dozens of women who were driving somewhere and ended up being intercepted in their car in basically the same streets that Hay would have been driving on. And that was never even considered. Even when you had a woman with a very similar sort of situation, kidnapped from very close to Campfield Learning Center and taken to Woodlawn Cemetery near the high school, that was before Anand's trial. They never even looked into it.
Well, let's talk about another possible suspect in the case. Though actually, it's the first time, I guess, we all saw Dawn as well. And that's her boyfriend at the time she disappeared, Donald Kleindienst.
First time I saw a picture of him from the time that he knew Hay.
Yeah, right. When he worked at the store.
Yeah, right. I'd seen photos from his high school and from, like, you know, when he was an adult.
But here's what threw me off, is that she described him in a way that even in that photograph didn't match up. In her diary, she describes Dawn as blonde, blue-eyed. Okay, he's blue-eyed and white, built. Fine. But she describes him as a blonde, and even his photograph with the whole team at LensCrafters, he's not blonde. His hair is dark.
And he's so, like, light brown.
That's not blonde. I mean,
people get confused about that. You're talking about your new older guy you have a crush on who is blue-eyed and has a Camaro. You can kind of hedge it and call it blonde in your diary. That doesn't surprise me.
Well, I mean, look, some of us, we have seen his high school photograph, and his high school photographs looks kind of similar to how he does now, which is, you know, kind of heavy, but, and also, you know, he has very dark hair in that photograph. He did look stunningly different at LensCrafters, which is not that many years out of high school. I mean, he looked like a handsome guy. I can see why she would have fallen for him, but oh my goodness, what transpired between him and Debbie was kind of shocking to me. I knew a little bit about it. I did not know the whole story. What do you think about that, Colin?
Yeah, well, this is something where I think we've wondered and other people have wondered. There's this interview that Debbie has, and she says, I suspected that Don, or as she calls him, Donnie, was the one who had abducted Hay and done harm to her. And so I called under that impression after sort of surreptitiously reaching out over email. And she said, we had a 7-hour call. And the question always was that a typo or a misprint?
Typo.
She confirms, no, it was a 7-hour call. I entered that call thinking that Don was guilty. I ended it thinking, well, no, he's innocent, and thinking that Adnan had done it. And then just the bombshell that we learn here is that, you know, at least according to Debbie, Don was romantically interested in Debbie and tried to put the moves on her, and she had to put the brakes on it and say, you know, I'm not interested in you that way. And that just adds another layer there when that's a part of this 7-hour conversation that essentially flips Debbie from someone who's very much thinking Adnan's innocent to now thinking he's guilty, which, I mean, that plays out to a large extent at trial.
And she still does.
Yeah, it still has ramifications today. Yeah. Absolutely.
I would just think that, I don't know, maybe, and I do want to talk about Debbie in a minute, but to me, the fact that my friend's boyfriend, my friend who disappeared and was murdered, her boyfriend, is very shortly after her murder making the moves on me would actually make me more suspicious of him rather than less suspicious of him. So I find that whole thing strange that suddenly she, although I don't know how persuasive Don was, but 7 hours is a long time. And Donnie was, and then they actually saw each other, and it sounds like something happened, but not everything happened, the way she put it. And that whole thing is just doesn't sit right with me. I don't know. I don't know what Donnie's deal was, but something about that is really fishy to me.
And I'm unclear on the timeline. Is it when she's still missing, or is it after her death? They start talking before her body's found. It's not clear to me when their mental relationship began. Was it before or after the body was found?
Yeah, I don't think that was clear. Yeah, that timeline. Yeah, she definitely reaches out to him and talks to him before the body's found, but I'm not sure this whole romantic angle when that takes place.
That happens after. That happens after, because I think she said it was spring break, okay, and that she went to UMBC, okay, and so it was spring. So that was definitely after the body. Not long after the body's found, but it was after the body's found.
I've been like March or April. Yeah, it's just, you know, from Debbie's, like, I get it. It's she's going through trauma. She's obviously not very used to attention from boys. She's out of her element and a bit naive. Yeah, like for her perspective, I understand. I can kind of get how this thing could happen, which is so, it does seem kind of horrific in some ways. Like, it's like, oh my God. But from her, I get it. That makes sense. It was not a great choice. She obviously was, you know, the intention
and she
and
kept
the
her boundaries. She kept
together.
Some boundaries. Yeah, she kept some boundaries.
It was, I'm not saying it's the worst thing in the world, but like this is poor judgment for a 17-year-old woman.
Right,
But what I don't get is from Don's perspective.
Yeah.
That's the harder part. I have a harder time explaining this as just like high school judgment, because he didn't know her. This wasn't like a case like old friends or something. This woman seeks you out, high school girl seeks you out and is like sending you an email to an anonymous name saying, where's Hay? Where are you hiding her? Can you tell me where she is? And you end up trying to start a relationship with her?
Like seduce her?
What? It doesn't seem like, it's very hard not to have questions about his motives. Is he just like a sleazy 22-year-old dude? Maybe. But, ugh. And they do talk in the documentary about how he is ill and he stopped working shortly after Hay's death and never worked again. To me, that's not part of the story. That's not really relevant necessarily. But the Debbie thing, it's bad judgment and terrible, terrible judgment all around for sure.
It always smelled fishy to me. I mean, like, the whole thing is weird. At the same time, even in the documentary, and he said this on Serial too, he's like, I still think about her every day. I loved her. Okay, look, maybe it's possible, but they had been dating for 2 weeks. The night she disappeared, he did not try to contact her. He, in fact, never tried to contact her again. I don't know what kind of love that is, but I also don't know if you can fall in love that quick. I don't understand. Why is he thinking about her every single day? Even why does he love her still? None of that makes sense to me. You know, they did not even have the kind of long-standing relationship that she had with her friends, or even Adnan. She knew Adnan for many, you know, number of years in high school. And the other thing the documentary doesn't address is something that's troubled all of us. And those are notes. In police notes, there's a line that says that the new boyfriend assaulted Debbie, meaning Donnie assaulted Debbie.
I've always wondered about that.
We don't know what we still don't know what that's about.
It's just an officer wrote down at some point. I believe the notes are from before the body's found, maybe. I think it's like early February, possibly. And it's clear it's just kind of someone's jotting down, not in an organized fashion, just going through about their work and writing down random bits of relevance. And one of them is new boyfriend assaulted Debbie.
So I guess she had seen him before.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to hear Don's perspective on what transpired between Debbie and him. He might have a very different take on the take that Debbie had. To the extent that Debbie is being accurate as to what happened, I mean, that's, as you say, on Debbie's part, maybe bad judgment, but on Don's behalf, especially Rabia, given what we just said about how he said he felt about Hay, if Debbie, again, is correct that when she is approaching Don and thinking that he had something to do with it and she's one of Hay's best friends, for him then to make sexual advances on her, again, if she's correct, that's hugely troubling in sort of looking at it. Whether you think that those are legitimate feelings he has, that has issues. If you think that he's sort of trying to convince her to not believe in his guilt and that's the reason he's doing it, either way, huge alarm bells. But again, we have to take what Debbie says with a grain of salt.
Well, Debbie does say she has a photographic memory, which, I mean...
Here's why all this matters, though. Because this is not Don's fault. His alibi was never checked into. He was never investigated as part of the murder investigation. All contact with him happened during the missing person case, and his alibi was never actually vetted at all. In fact, they talked to his stepmother to get, like, on the phone to get confirmation. He was never questioned about it. No one's ever, like, looked into it at the time. And that is not – Don can't control – that was not his responsibility or fault in any way. That's beyond him. But the consequence that he now has to deal with is that he doesn't have an alibi for – what happened the day that Hay died.
And of course, contextualizing this and stating the importance is that according to Debbie, she is the very last person to see Hay alive. She sees her around 3 p.m. as she's leaving the school. And at least according to the police statement, she says she's going to see Don. Now, she claims later it was to pick up the cousins and then go see Don. But the statement just says to see Don. So there are questions about whether Debbie has the right day, but she's potentially the most important witness in this case because, according to her own claim, she is the last innocent person to see Hay alive.
You know what question we didn't get answered, though, about Don?
What's that?
Why in neither trial, in two trials he testified, he couldn't spell his own last name right?
What?
I just always wondered about that. How in two different trials can you not spell Kleindienst correctly? And he spells it different ways, too.
You mean he actually spelled it out loud on the stand? I don't remember that.
In the transcripts, yeah. Yeah.
Transcripts. Unless it's transcribed wrong, could it be? I don't know.
It could be.
All right. So let's close out with, I think, a bit of information, a revelation really that was pretty devastating, but also completely new to me, frankly. It was completely new to me. And that is about Hay being a victim of sexual abuse. This is not something I had actually ever heard before. Had you guys?
There are a few things in her diary, I mean, when I first read it, that I remember wondering about. And she's, you know, her writing style's kind of all over the place. She can go from, like emojis to, like, joking really quick. So it's hard to tell from her writing style. But there were a couple of lines I'm reading. I'm like, whoa, is there something more going on here? Is there something she's sort of, not hinting at because it's her own diary, but, like, referencing things that I remember having the question anyways, what I'm saying. And so I was not totally shocked to hear that she had spoken to several people about it.
I had heard that there might have been some physical assault or physical violence in the home.
She did talk about that too.
Did they talk about that?
No, in her diary. She did. She was more outright about that.
Right. And there was something that happened with the diary, I remember, where there were parts of it that were marked out. And I can't remember who brought up that they weren't marked out before, but then her mom got it and gave it back. They were marked out. Maybe the mom didn't want some, you know. There could be things in there that obviously, I mean, and the other thing in the documentary is very, you know, showed how none of her friends ever got inside her home. Her home life was completely separate from the rest of her life. And that's also kind of a new part of the story because until now, it's always been Adnan's home life that's been really examined and not Hay's home life. And I thought that was interesting and important. What did you think about that, Colin, and how that added to this story?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to what we said at the start of this episode, which is to say, you know, I think a great service this documentary has done, even just in this first episode, is to give us more insight into Hay, who she was, her history, what made her who she is. And in terms of the actual case and the investigation here, yeah, I think that this underscored something we've seen a bit in terms of looking through the documents and reporting, is just that his home life was so separate from her school life. And yeah, to hear, you know, none of these friends had been inside the house, it was sort of these two separate lives that she had. And probably this case, the way it was investigated, was very different from what you might see with someone who has their friends coming into their house and has those interactions, where that would have led, I think, to a very different investigation than the one we had in this case.
And the other big issue from the missing persons part of the investigation that never gets resolved and still isn't resolved today is about Hay's father in California, that she supposedly was going to go see. And they've never, ever, I mean, we know who the stepfather presumably is, that, you know, someone her mom was in a relationship with at one point. For me, there's big questions about, one, where that story even came from. It did start circulating at one point, but I mean, I think the first person we have record talking about it is Dawn. But right. If that is the case, that she was talking about going to see her father in California, when you have a teenage girl missing for that long, that should be like a heavy focus where you're looking. And they don't seem to have checked into it at all.
Well, I guess they kind of didn't need to, because they found her here. Any last thoughts before we wrap up our coverage of the first episode?
No, I think this was a good sort of reintroduction of the case, adding that different facet of the video. And, you know, it lays the foundation. We'll see what they have to report in episodes 2 through 4.
So I will say this, and this is what I've been told, is that this first episode is largely narrative and pointing out some of the issues and questions in the case. But the next few are going to be pretty deeply investigative, and I think that's going to be of special interest, especially to undisclosed listeners. So thank you guys for tuning in this week. Make sure you subscribe and stay with us as we cover this series. Tweet your questions at us. Use the hashtag, as you always have, hashtag UD Addendum. And we'll get to your questions on our Addenda series with John Cryer.